We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, we're expecting to have here this morning with us in the studio Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, has a private practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School, and every other month on a Monday she is here and we talk about women's health. And her visit this time around is certainly very timely. I'm sure that she will have some things to say on recent changes in recommendations for mammography and also for pap smears. This is something that has come up just recently and seems to be a case where the medical community is a little bit divided on whether they want to go with these new recommendations or not. It seems like depending on who you talk to, you maybe get a little bit different answer. So we'll get her take on it here in the first part of the program. And of course, anything that falls within her area of practice is certainly welcome, too. We've talked about a lot of things before on the program, issues relating to conception and birthing and osteoporosis and all sorts of things as well, and as well as the kind of screening tests that are recommended for women to have. So she's here in the studio. She's getting herself set up, and we're really pleased that she's here. And, of course, we're open to questions, and whenever we have physicians on the program, I kind of like to remind people that doing diagnosis over the phone is just, well, we can't do that. But we do these programs so that you can have the opportunity to ask some basic questions, and perhaps that can help you out, add to your health knowledge. And then, of course, if you have real concerns, you need to pursue that with your own physician or someone who can see you. But other than that, we're certainly open to whatever sorts of questions that you might have. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you can certainly call us. Well, good to see you once again.
Good morning.
I feel like I haven't seen you. In fact, I think I probably haven't seen you since July. So it's been a long time.
One year or another.
Well, okay. And I expect that one of the things that here you would want to talk about right up front are these new recommendations about mammograms. And I'm sure people have heard about this and no doubt are confused because different physicians seem to have a different take on this.
Different physicians will have a different take. Different organizations have a different take. And I think it's always a good idea to take a step back and realize that when these organizations make their recommendations, what they're doing is they're sitting down and they're looking at available evidence from research studies that are done already. So as physicians are practicing along, a study may come out in a particular journal or another study may come out in another journal. And it's always a challenge to know, well, should we change our mode of practice just because a particular new study came out? And I can give you some better analogies on that if you'd like at some point. But basically, when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force came out with their somewhat, to some individuals, shocking recommendations that women can safely have fewer mammograms last week, we have to realize that the studies that they were quoting were already read by most of us that follow the literature and were understood as where they were in the scientific information. And the organizations that still, quote unquote, oppose these recommendations, they do and they don't. They oppose them in that they're different recommendations than these other organizations have. And these organizations, like U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, have their own schedule of review of the different recommendations. So we're in this unfortunate situation, again, because it was much like this 20 years ago, where different organizations have different recommendations because they haven't exactly weighed in. Now, I think some of the other organizations like American College of obstetricians gynecologists. They're also being called American Congress of Obstetrician Gynecologists. So if you see either of those terms, they're identical. The college refers to the people and the Congress refers to the organization of the people, if that makes any sense to you. We just had a name change. But at any rate, that one organization known as ACOG has reaffirmed their prior recommendations. But on the other hand, much of the information in the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommendation set is very valid information and maybe very worthwhile you discussing with your individual physician.
Hmm. Well, now it's my understanding that, again, your college, that is the obstetricians and gynecologists, ACOG, and the American Cancer Society, and now I think even after the study, the federal government continues to say it is their recommendation that a woman have her first baseline mammogram when she's 40.
Right.
Now, this recent study that started all this discussion says 50. So what is you're speaking as an individual physician. So
sure.
Now what are you telling your patients?
Well, I think first and foremost, everybody is an individual. When you sit down in your own private doctor's office with your own private physician, you go over your individual risks. And there's no question amongst the guidelines if you have any sort of risk. I think that puts you into the category where you're going to have earlier mammograms. There's also the group of patients that's now already had their first screening mammogram by age 40, say that a 45-year-old. And now what are you going to do? Are you going to hold off to age 50 if you really have no risk factors? What else is going on? Do you have a good diet? Do you have any family history at all on either side? Do you exercise? Do you have any hormone use? Have you had breast biopsies? I think we're going to take the whole woman into consideration before we just chalk it off and say, come back at age 50. But for the properly counseled individual who might have extraordinary low risk and wishes to evaluate that information and go with her first mammogram at age 50, I think physicians are going to feel that there is some medical justification for doing that with an individual patient.
And now for, say, we have a woman who has been having mammograms regularly as per the old recommendations, and she's let us say her risk factors are low. Let us say that they've all been good up till this point. Now, would the recommendation be, or how would you talk with that patient about, do you need to continue to have mammogram every year?
Well, some of those patients will obviously be eligible to potentially be triaged into an every other year regimen if your physician's group practice is going to go with that. I think there are enough organizations sticking with the every year. There are enough insurance companies still funding the every year. It's so new. Literally, the ink is barely dry on this report, and the actual report is fairly thick. And I would venture to say that most practicing physicians have not read it letter for letter. And I doubt, honestly, if too many individual physicians are going to make big recommendation changes yet. And many in the United States, many individuals practice in group practices where the internists, the family practice docs, the gynees are all getting together and trying to practice under one big umbrella and trying to have one protocol that sort of suits all so as to best serve most of the patients. And I think that you'll probably find some support still in the near term for those every year exams. But I would venture to say that we'll trickle down to those every other year exams for the extraordinarily low-risk patient.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist, has a practice in our area. She also is clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here ready to go, starting with line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a more of a political question, I think. I have a friend who lives now in, I believe, Kentucky, and she's pregnant, and she's just moved there. She's not got a lot of options as far as the doctors that she can see, and she's very concerned because she actually trained as a doula, and she's overweight, but she knows a lot about the birthing process, and she's very concerned that she's not going to have any recourse with these doctors as to whether they're going to just cut a big, huge slit into her stomach when she's due. I know it's not her stomach, but and I wondered if you had any knowledge of or advice for someone who's really concerned that the doctor may not honor their wishes or may go to a radical procedure without really considering the needs of the patient. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, if I understand the question correctly, the question is, one, how can an obese pregnant woman minimize her risk for a cesarean birth? I think that's part one of maybe your questions. Number two, what is the safest birth for mom and baby would be number three. Number two part of the question. Number three part of the question would be communicating with your healthcare provider. And I think that it's always a challenge to communicate with your healthcare provider. There are all kinds of different tools that we try to use to figure out ways to get those kinds of pieces of information to patients. Definitely there's a feel that patients have for themselves and their healthcare provider, and sometimes they may not see eye to eye. In certain areas of medicine, like obstetrics, per se, obstetrics is regionalized into care, and your friend may or may not. We're not taking care of an individual. We're talking about whole groups of women. So, for instance, certain hospitals are designated appropriate for low-risk patients. Other hospitals are designated appropriate for patients with some high-risk factors. And then there are what's called perinatal centers. And it may be that someone who progresses through pregnancy, who begins extraordinarily obese, let's just say as a discussion point, might have her best chance of gaining the least amount of weight, of having a normal-sized baby rather than a macrosomic baby, and maximize her chance to deliver naturally, to be with a perinatologist, get a whole teamwork of care going, get her weight managed and get followed closely, get delivered when it's the safest for the baby. These kinds of issues may actually maximize the chance that somebody would have a vaginal birth versus a cesarean birth. In terms of what we would call a radical procedure, definitely I think every woman has to sit down with her delivering provider, and there's a lot of education that has to happen in those next, you know, we nickname it 9 months, but, you know, most people don't walk in the door prior to pregnancy. They walk in the door a couple of months pregnant, and so we've got, you know, a good 4, 5, 6 months to get that education piece going. And what's going to be the least amount of radicalness for the patient in some cases, for instance, might be a cesarean, as actual death rates for cesarean are probably, if anything, equivalent or almost equivalent. You have to do about 20,000 C-sections to have the death of a mom from one C-section. Now, you know, not that we shouldn't avoid C-sections and lower our risk, but those are the kinds of issues that you have to talk to your healthcare provider upfront about. And that's where birth planning helps. That's where sometimes making that pregnancy plan before you even conceive can help as well.
All right, I hope that helps. Again, our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program every other month on a Monday, and we talk about women's health. And if you have questions, I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Cisco is the next caller in line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had gotten a... shortly after my son was born, a 10-year IUD, and he's 7 now, and I was just curious if the effectiveness, does that decrease at all, or the older the IUD gets?
No.
Okay,
I'm assuming that you have a Paragard, because it's actually approved for 10 years. There are actually some countries that have approved it for 12, but U.S., we recommend that you change it after 10, and its effectiveness has been studied up to that time. The greatest expulsion rate actually is in that first year. Once you get past that first year, the failure rates are virtually identical to sterilization failure rates. So failures are in the range of 1 to 3 per thousand after that first point.
Okay, great. That's what I needed. I feel comfortable now. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go back to another caller. This is someone in Lovington, line 1. Hello.
Hi. My question, I think, maybe had something to do with the second caller and also with the change in recommendations for the screening process. I think in this area, I'm down here at Lovington, I have a great variety of quality of care, I feel. Do they take into consideration that when they do this? Because I know two different women that have had breast cancer that got regular mammographies, that nothing showed up. One of them had had it, you know, like 2 months previous, and then, you know, then felt a lump. And you just got, to me, I got to wonder, in certain cases, I guess, it seems like it's questionable after the interpretations of the tests and all that I hear about, the value of this thing. And I just wanted to see if you comment on that.
Excellent question. What you're referring to is what we call the false positive and false negative rate of mammograms, and that's exactly what they're addressing. Exactly. So the point of a single test is that it is literally a screening test. So a mammogram is not a diagnosis. It's an indication for further testing. It cannot actually firmly make the diagnosis. And it has a false negative rate. And we usually quote that false negative rate to be about 3%. The false positive rate has been changing. So false negative means there's actually a cancer there. What you're talking about, there's actually a cancer there, but for some reason it's not seen, either because it's missed by the person looking at the x-ray or because it can't be differentiated yet from the surrounding tissue, and so it cannot be picked up by that particular technology. So there are even, for instance, actual lumps that you can actually physically feel. You can even sometimes physically see these things from across the room, but for whatever reason, they don't image differently on a mammogram. So that is an example of a false negative that's kind of a curious type of false negative. Now, there are false positives as well. There are people who are told, oh, this mammogram's suspicious, but it turns out after chasing it with other confirmatory tests that we don't find anything wrong. That's false positive. So one of the purposes of repeat screening tests, whether it be mammograms or pap smears for women or PSA tests for men or repeat blood pressures when you go into your doctor's office frequently, the purpose of repeat testing is to minimize that false negative rate. So the idea is that, okay, you might miss something one time. It's not so likely if you're getting regular exams that you're going to miss it over and over and over again. And that's the purpose of having those repeat recommendations. Same too, that's how those intervals are established. So what's going on with the breast cancer? Breast cancer starts as a single cell. When we make a diagnosis of cancer that was actually first picked up by a suspicious mammogram, it's probably been in our body for in the 8 to 10 year range. When we make a diagnosis of cancer that we have felt by feeling a lump, it's probably been in our bodies somewhere in that 10 to 12 year range. So what they're looking at is, okay, let's say we now do those exams every couple of years. So we're maybe not picking it up at 8 years. Maybe we are picking it up at that 10-year. But what's the outcome of breast cancers picked up on mammogram as its first sign? Very good. In some studies, they practically quote 100% survival. In other words, women die of something else once that's found. It's not a great thing to have, but women die of something else. So the point is that maybe that interval can be safely stretched. By stretching that interval, maybe we can back off so much irradiation. Maybe with that interval, some women can be spared some anxiety. Maybe it's not safe. Maybe that interval, by looking at new studies, should be collapsed and maybe even do them more frequently. And so it is a risk-benefit ratio. And that's exactly what you have to work out with your own health care provider. And, of course, I think our insurance companies will have a little extra say about that.
Well, you know, it seems to me that
gets back to the political.
That part of the motivation behind the new recommendations was that there was this feeling that you were actually getting a lot of false positives. That is, mammograms that were saying there's cancer here when there's not. And then the concern is that there are women who are then getting a lot, you know, naturally, if someone told you you had breast cancer, you'd be anxious, and maybe then you're going on to have biopsies and things that it turns out weren't really necessary.
Well, and I know what you're saying. And when you discuss these guidelines amongst friends and even sometimes physicians amongst colleagues, yes, you use the word feeling, quote unquote, but actually there were guidelines, there were actual research studies. You can look at, for instance, the rate of biopsy in the United States versus the rate of biopsy in a place like United Kingdom, where we have about the identical rate of breast cancer, but we do many more biopsies. We do many more callbacks. We repeat mammograms a lot more frequently, but we don't diagnose any greater incidence of breast cancer. So it wasn't just a feeling. It was a hard look at some very difficult data sets, and they will be taking another hard look at these sets, and you can be sure all these other organizations will as well.
Well, I'll ask this question, and I promise I'll get on to another caller. With mammograms, do you see more false positives than you see false negatives?
I would probably say yes to that, correct. False negative rate is low. But it's definitely there.
Right. Well, let's talk with another caller here on Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
This is a follow-up call, actually, to an earlier caller's points. This is about the woman who's pregnant, who is obese. I'm the mother of that woman. My daughter is extremely well-educated. She is obese. She has held her weight through her pregnancy. She has 6 weeks to go till delivery. She has very strong ideas about how she would like her birth to proceed. She walked into her first OBGYN with a birth plan. She's a very soft, non-confrontational human being. But the combination between her being obese and she's actually very poor, these two things seem to have conspired to create a very negative climate between her and her gynecologist, in which he seems to not respect her. And because she's obese and because she's poor, it is as if she does not have the right to have an opinion. She changed doctors from her first one, who was resistant to any of normally advanced ideas that are current with well-educated people now. She switched doctors. She went in having written down some of her ideas, and when she handed it to the physician, he passed it back to her and basically threw her out of his office. With 6 weeks to go, she's in a panic, and actually so am I, since I'm her mother. She's in a place where she has very few options. She's gone to the next larger neighboring city, and most of those physicians aren't taking patients, and indeed patients who need some public aid for the medical care. And maybe I'm just calling because I don't maybe there are some other people in this actually political plight that could identify with this horrible situation. And I wonder what kind of comment or suggestion you have to make about this.
Well, I'm definitely feeling like, given the context of a 34-week pregnant patient, there are so many different factors that could be going on in somebody's pregnancy, and as I've said, it is unfortunate, but it's hard to give any kind of real advice over the radio. It is sometimes difficult to find healthcare providers for obstetrics, particularly in certain parts of the country. It has been. There are certain states that are called red states, and you can look on the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists website, and I think in their public section they have some information about this. There are other organizations that watch this as well. Perhaps the NIH site does, or the CDC sites, or the public health sites may track where people do have trouble finding providers, and all the reasons that obstetrician gynecologists are not plentiful in certain parts of our state as well as other states, and that's not really my role in this program. But whenever an individual has a difference of opinion between her provider and herself, at least a second opinion is a good idea. And even another state would be forming what we call perinatal networks. And perinatal networks are mandated to see the patients within their network and give opinions. And there may or may not be something else going on. Obese patients, the safest for them to in terms of birth may or may not be a vaginal delivery, because patients that are obese may wind up with skin infections from cesareans and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But also when somebody doesn't feel that they are communicating with their physician, we often advocate that you bring an adult English-speaking family member with that individual who can maybe take some notes, maybe not even speak, but take notes, and that way sometimes the communications, what the physician is saying and what you're hearing secondhand may be 100% correct, and it may, however, be translated in an emotional way that may lead to some rhetoric that is confusing.
Yes, well, she's tried that, having somebody with her, and the other person concurred that there's a real problem of prejudice and sort of ignorance going on, and it's just a difficult situation. She's pretty upset all the time, which isn't the greatest thing for her. And the options there seem to be limited, but I will check the websites, and I thank you for this information.
All right. Thanks for the call. Best of luck with that.
Thank you.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a private practice here in our area, the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She also teaches at U of I Med School. And every other month she's here, we talk about women's health. And I know she will do her best to help you out, answer your questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just one, I expect you probably also want to talk about pap smears. Can I go on and just ask you one other question? Again, coming out of the study about mammograms. Another aspect of this, there was something about how it had to do with women's self-breast exam, and that the people who wrote the study said that they weren't sure it was such a good idea to teach women to examine their own breasts. Now, at the same time, it didn't seem like they were saying that women shouldn't do it, but that there seemed to be some, and I was quite confused about this, what was being said about breast self-exam and whether that was advisable or not, or whether you should advise women to do it or not, or what is your take on that?
Well, there have been a number of studies over the past, at least a year, maybe two or three, since time flies, that show that women who participate in breast self-examinations come in for more checkups, get more mammograms, get more ultrasounds, actually get more biopsies. it leads to more interventions for usually what tends to be non-significant abnormalities. Also, most of the studies done on breast self-examinations were not very rigorous studies. Much of the breast self-examination promotion came about because it intuitively seemed like a good idea. Oh, you might feel a lump. Feel. And it just started, took off from there. And American Cancer Society, for quite some time, backed off on its general recommendations on breast self-exam and said, if you're going to do an exam, do it well and go over with your healthcare provider how to do that exam. And what it turns out in these recommendations, what they are actually saying is there aren't enough good studies to really get behind this as a good recommendation or not. So it's somewhat of a hanging recommendation, but that the only studies that were done well show that potentially it causes more harm than benefit for the average person.
All right. Let's go to another call here. Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask the doctor, in all this uproar over the frequency of getting mammograms, what are the recommendations for African-American women? Is it the same or different?
Well, right now the general recommendations still go by age. And I do think that you're bringing up an excellent point that as we move towards the future, we're going to go by risk categorizations. And for a long time, they were calculating that the average risk for an African-American woman at 30 equaled the Caucasian risk at 40. And if you're just going by statistical risk, there would be different age recommendations for different ethnicities. Now, given that many people out there have mixed ethnicities or don't even know if they have mixed ethnicities, it's very difficult to come out with recommendations like that. But you're absolutely right that ethnicity should play a part of these guidelines. But so far, they're really focusing in strictly on age or those known to be known carriers of specific genetic risks.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, let's go and talk about pap smears. Now, there we had all these stories about the recommendations and the discussion debate about mammograms. Well, it was like a week after that. I think actually it was less than a week. Your college, ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, issued some new recommendations for pap smears. And the recommendation was that women should start later. So they bumped up the age of when you should have your first one.
Well, they bumped up the age for some people.
Okay. So,
it's so, again, does so it, confusing.
So is it, again, the same? It goes back to the same thing that you have to look at a person's risk profile first?
Well, ideally. Well, when I was in medical school, we used to recommend starting the first pap smear about 16. I think halfway through my career, we bumped that to 18. And now it's get your first pap smear at age 21.
Okay.
Now, the past few years, they had changed that recommendation when they bumped it from around age 18 for your first pap smear. They bumped it to age 21, unless you've been sexually active for 3 years, then get your first pap. Now they've removed that sexually active for 3 years verbiage. And part of that has to do with the fact that, yes, young people will pick up the human papillomavirus if they're sexually active. Yes, that will impact their pap smear, but they are so likely to resolve that problem and so unlikely to progress to cervical cancer before you get that first pap smear in at age 21, that you are sacrificing exams but not the health, and you're preserving the health of the cervix by doing these fewer pap smears so that fewer surgical interventions get done. Because right now, all we have to treat human papillomavirus infection with is nothing. Prevention.
Well, that's where we come back to the vaccine.
Well,
now that we have.
We have two vaccines available. We have the Gardasil, which has been available first, and it covers four different types of human papillomavirus. It also, if you've not acquired some of the related types to those four types, it will offer you some protection. And we just now have a Cervivax that strictly covers 16 and 18, the two most important types of HPV for causing cervical cancer. If you have been vaccinated for those two types of HPV prior to acquiring either of those two types of HPV, you are virtually guaranteed to not get dysplasia of the vulva, of the vagina, of the rectum, of the cervix, of the probably of the oral area as well. And so it is, it says in these new guidelines that they aren't thinking in terms of the population being vaccinated and therefore less frequently going to be seen with these diseases. But one would have to assume that that's in the back of our minds.
Uh-huh. All right. So now the ACOG, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, says women should get their first. The general recommendation is women should have their first Pap smear, their first screening for cervical cancer, 21. Now, after that, how often should it be repeated?
Well, again, we're in this transition phase. Not every physician's probably even read these new guidelines. Not every physician goes with the American College. And so there are other organizations that, again, still probably have their own guidelines. What it was before is that if you've had three negatives 3 years in a row and you were known to be HPV negative as well, and you had a low-risk partner, and you had no new partners, and you could maybe start doing less frequent pap smears, slip to every 2 to 3 years. But since pelvic examinations, where we feel the uterus and ovaries, were recommended on a yearly basis, and most women mentally tag that pelvic examination in with the pap, most gynecologists just did the pap when they do a pelvic exam. And that may still be true. But from age 21 to 29, now they're recommending the every 2 year pap because screening, again, this is what I was talking about with the mammograms. They are discovering that stretching that screening interval out, you will pick up fewer people in those lower stages. But clinically, is that going to make any difference? And that with this particular condition, you're going to give more individuals a chance for something you would have picked up to resolve. And so a whole hullabaloo that you would have brought the patient in for in terms of extra examinations, focused microscopic examinations, will be eliminated by doing those less frequent interval screenings.
Okay. Just to, for a second to go back to the vaccine that we have now for HPV, for human papilloma virus, the idea here is that by giving young women, maybe someday we're going to give it to boys, I guess we haven't quite decided on yet, the vaccine that against certain forms of the virus, that what we're going to do is put a serious dent in cancer, for cervical cancer for women. How I just wonder how many years will it take of giving the vaccine and then, you know, accumulating data and so forth before we could actually say that it has
eradicated
done that.
Cervical
well, I don't
cancer.
Know about eradicate, but you know, get to the point where, you know, we start to see a statistically significant decline in cervical cancer.
Oh, we should see a statistically significant decline in cervical cancer in just a few years.
Mm-hmm.
We already, even after the first shot, you can see a statistically significant, and it's a 3-shot series, in case somebody listening doesn't know this, but it's a 3-shot series. But even after the very first shot, I've been in these trials, and I'm still in some of these ongoing trials, you see a statistically significant decrease in dysplasia of the cervix or the precancerous changes that in some cases will lead to cervical cancer.
And you use the word eradicate. I don't know, is anybody really expecting that this is going, that we're not going to see any more cervical cancer?
Well, we definitely need a better vaccine for that because there are only four types of HPV in our vaccine. And there are in the research trials that I'm involved with, we're studying 16 different types of high-risk HPV viruses. So this particular shot will not eradicate all of cervical cancer by any means. But we could eradicate about 80%, we think. And we think that as we get better vaccinations, that we will get closer and closer and closer. What will happen probably is the less frequently seen types of HPV will become a little bit more common. There probably are some cases that are not only related to the HPV virus that, of course, we'll still see. So eradication, probably an overstatement, but very close to the point that an average gynecologist like myself that routinely in her career diagnoses cervical cancers as I practice will maybe not see one. In 10 or 20 years.
Okay. Next caller, Champagne, line one, right here. Hello.
Hi, just a quick question on that whole topic. How does one get screened for the HPV or the type you might have if you do have it? And how frequently do you do that screening?
The FDA a few years ago approved that women age 30 and over could get screened on their pap smear test. And originally the test approved was the Digene hybrid capture. They've been acquired by Qiagen, I believe. And so it has a slightly different name now. Several other companies are perfecting tests that can be done in conjunction with your pap smear to determine whether or not you have that virus. And we've routinely been doing it on patients who have slightly abnormal pap smears. And when patients get new partners or they have a slightly abnormal pap or they are over the age of 30, it greatly enhances the pickup rate and the statistical prediction as to whether or not you're going to go on to have cervical cancer by getting one of these screening tests. And you should definitely ask your healthcare provider about it.
Well, so when I get my results back from my pap smear, do those results come in, or do you have to ask for them separately?
Would have been a separate test. It is a separate bill. But absolutely. So at your next appointment, you discuss with your physician that you would like to be screened for the HPV. And if their lab tests for it, they certainly can do that. And if you had a pap smear yesterday, the lab probably still has enough fluid and in good enough condition that they could do that test.
Okay.
But if you had it maybe, say, 2 weeks ago, they probably still have fluid. They keep it for up to 21 days, I believe is the standard in most labs, but it probably can't be run on a sample.
Yeah. I was just wondering because I get my results back for the pap smear, but there's never anything that says more specific to anything.
Your healthcare. Right. Your healthcare provider hasn't yet gotten into routinely offering that for their patients. It's a relatively expensive test. I myself in my practice try to educate all my age 30 and up patients, but we also get into the bind where if somebody gets that test and all they requested was a pap smear, it can be more of a challenge to cover that, but it's going to be so worth getting that test if you're going to slip to an every two-year pap smear. And this is what I talk to my patients about in most of the research trials, although most of our trials right now are on other things.
Okay, great. Thanks for your information.
All right, thank you. Just let me ask you a real quick question here. If a woman tests positive for the human papilloma virus, is there any point for her getting the HPV vaccine? Will that do anything at that point, or is it too late at that point?
Most of the studies show that if anybody is already infected with HPV virus, they're not likely to be infected with all four subtypes of the vaccine.
So there
that
would
they
be a reason.
Still are candidate okay. for the HPV vaccine. So anybody who falls within the age category for the HPV vaccine or anybody who wants to spend their money for it ages 25 to 45, I'm still an advocate of it.
So even if you say you have a woman who is in her 30s, has been sexually active, shows no sign of HPV infection, but for somebody like that, you would say, well, maybe it would be a good idea for you to
have
the
FDA
vaccine.
Is looking at that. It's not yet an approved vaccine for women of that age so that it wouldn't be covered by your insurance. It's okay. about a $360 series of for the whole vaccine. So it's a bit of an investment. And we're hoping that the FDA will look at the published data and the data that has been provided to them and get that approval.
So right now their recommendation seems it's concentrating on younger women who are either not sexually active at all.
Active.
That's the idea before.
And they're focusing on the catch-up group being that group between about 18 and 26.
Okay. Line 4, it's next. Chicago. Hello.
Hello. I'm getting back to the topic of breast cancer. I've heard of research showing a link between abortion and breast cancer. It increases the risk of breast cancer. And I'm just wondering, is this related to the hormonal changes that a woman goes through when she has an abortion, similar to the hormone replacement therapy? Would that be the reason for that?
There have been very good studies disproving the link between abortion and breast cancer. So there is no link.
I see. I heard of a recent study out of Turkey, in fact, just this year, another study. Most of it's from outside the United States. And I was just saying, I guess there's a split of opinion on that then.
Well, there's no split of opinion in the ranks of the scientists in the United States.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. We have a couple of minutes left, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist, has practice in our area, teaches at the U of I Med School. Every other month on a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health, and she is here and talks a little bit about things that are new. We respond to questions. She does her best. And again, at the beginning of these programs, whenever we have a doctor here on the show, I always say we need to be careful about what we can do over the telephone, but questions are certainly welcome, and we have time for one or two, I'm sure, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Anything, something else that you maybe like to talk about?
Well, yes, the American College of Medical Geneticists a few years ago began recommending that women prior to pregnancy, and this is where we get back to that pregnancy planning visit, which is just so critical, and hopefully everybody will do one of those before they get pregnant. But one of the things that you can get is a blood test to see whether or not you carry any mutations that would potentially lead for your child to get cystic fibrosis. And they recommended a panel that checks for 23 different mutations. And we have known that certain ethnicities are at much greater risk for these mutations. And there is a new company that has produced a test. And it's out of the Sequinom Center for Molecular Medicine, and they are introducing their Sensigene cystic fibrosis test, and it tests for 103 different mutations. And I apologize, I didn't have time to check prior to this programming if you know what kind of insurance company and what kind of access we have in regular labs to this particular technology. But I anticipate that we will get this technology fairly quickly implemented. So almost, you know, well, four and a half times the number of mutations being detected. So that's a really big advance. They're saying that if you actually look at all the different ethnicities, that you have about a 1 in 30 chance of being a cystic fibrosis carrier, which is pretty high. Higher than what I've been quoting to my patients, according to their new information.
Okay. Let's try and get at least one more caller here in Leroy. Line 4. Hello.
Hi. I had to step out a couple of minutes, so I hope I'm not being redundant. Have you spoken yet about the Gardasil for boys?
Well, I didn't cover that. We know that Gardasil for boys is going to be effective at preventing genital warts, and so that the shot for them will have some substantive benefit in terms of prevention of warts in those individuals. We do think that it will have some herd immunity benefits and help prevent transmission from males to females as they get older. And that's, of course, part of what we're interested in, so that it would be Gardasil that would be indicated for males and prevention of those conditions, not the Cervavax, which really covers only 16, 18, whereas the Gardasil covers 6, 11, 16, 18, and it's the 6 and 11 component that really have the most impact on HPV. But as far as I know, that it's not yet approved by insurance companies.
It's not. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Yeah, but you think, though, that's at some point that it will?
I think so. They are vaccinating boys in other countries. They've been vaccinating in Australia for quite some time.
One quick, not really enough time to deal with this substantively, but you know, one thing we know about healthcare in the United States is we're spending a lot of money. We're spending more money than a lot of other developed countries, not necessarily getting the benefit. So here this morning we've talked about two instances where screening tests, we're recommending that fewer tests be done. And I think that is in part because people have looked at these statistics and said, we're doing a lot of testing. We're not picking up that much cancer. So we have to ask, is it worth the amount of money that we're spending? I think some people have raised similar kind of questions about screening for prostate cancer, for example. I wonder, are we going to get to the point where, and a lot of the recommendations for various kinds of screenings that we have done for years and years and years are going to change?
Well, I would hope that as I look into my crystal ball, that we will focus our screenings. We will identify genetic risk, focus our screenings on the people that are at most risk for certain diseases. And I think understanding the Human Genome Project and being able to really apply that technology to an individual will help us there. Also, preventing the diseases we can prevent. We don't need to screen for smallpox because we have eradicated smallpox. So we don't need to go looking at people's spots to see if they're smallpox. So this is where we're hoping to go in the future. We do a lot of screening for chlamydia, but for instance, I'm involved in a very early trial looking for antibodies that could be helpful in the development of a chlamydia vaccine. So if anybody had a tubal pregnancy out there and you also had a diagnosis of chlamydia, I need your blood. But beyond that, a little sidebar there. But if we get proper vaccinations, we start eliminating certain diseases, we'll be able to focus our healthcare dollars elsewhere. Pregnancy prevention is good medicine. If you plan your pregnancy and you go into pregnancy being healthy, you don't have to spend as much money on taking care of the problems in the pregnancy. So that's the way I look at things. Okay.
There, we'll have to leave it to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an OBGYN in private practice here in our area. She's with us every other month, always on a Monday. And I guess that we'll see you in January, right?
Thank you,
okay,
yes.
Okay, thanks.